Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And as promised, we start today to bring you our interviews with prominent chefs and restaurateurs from London, one of our favorite cities in the whole entire world. And didn't we have a good time?
We did. And it was a busy place. And it only rained one day.
Right.
So that was pretty special.
And we lost the umbrella.
That was. So anyway, in this week's program, we reacquainted ourselves with a chef we met for the first time more than 10 years ago.
Yes.
And he's gone from strength to strength since then. So you'll get a fascinating story of a restaurant called Wild Honey in the celebrated part of London called Mayfair. And at the other end of the social scale, a chef who is part of a group called, so now you call them the Young Turks.
Right.
That we had read about, and whose restaurant we hadn't gotten to, despite the fact that he doesn't particularly care about Michelin stars. He's had one for 2 years. He's a man with a mission. In a rather more working class area of London, in the east called Shoreditch. So we've gone from Mayfair to Shoreditch all in one week. How about that?
As they say, time flies. I'm rather astounded to realize that our interviewee for today, Anthony Dimitri, actually, we met him probably 10 years ago. At another one of his restaurants called, I always pronounce this wrong because it's a tree, Arbutus, but it's, and this particular restaurant is called Wild Honey, and we were here, but they have changed a lot since then. The structure has changed, the decor, I'm assuming the menu, but Anthony, you seem as freshly inspired as you were 10 years ago.
Oh my goodness, nothing's changed. I'm still highly driven. I still work like a dog. But that's the nature of the beast. Since we last spoke, lots has changed. I acquired another restaurant prior to us meeting, which was Le Deux Salons in Covent Garden. That has since been sold. I sold that to Sir Terence Conran. He has kept the name, by the way. But it's got nothing to do with me anymore. Arbutus, where we last met, has now been sold. Since our last meeting, I have split with my business partner very amicably, Will Smith. We've decided to go separate ways. Arbutus had to be sold for me to finance William, which has now been resolved. But Wild Honey is my baby, and I continue to strive and push it into the echelons of London's premier restaurants. You're very right in saying that the decor has changed. We've modernized it somewhat, made it a bit more feminine, introduced some fantastic photography, which I'm a big fan of, some modern photography. Hence the Tim Walker on the wall over there, which we're looking at. That's a beautiful piece. We've got some great sculptures by an artist sculptor who's based in Bath, which is southwest England. Things have changed, and people do change, and things move on. But my ethos still remains the same: great value, affordable dining, in a relaxed environment.
I seem to feel that it's posher than it was before. Are you still after the same clientele?
Well, you won't believe, but Arbutus is kind of 10-minute stroll from here in the heart of Soho. This is Mayfair. We have one of London's finest streets, which divides the two areas, which is Regent Street, and that's almost like the River Seine. So you have the left bank and the right bank. Here, it's much more affluent, very different clientele. And as a businessman, as a chef, you have to know your market. And here, we've, as you can see, we've got tablecloths But we still remains the same ethos throughout. The red bonquettes are to signify a more relaxed environment, what you'll find in the Grand Brasseries of Paris. Some beautiful furniture, but it's more than anything, it's a very convivial room, very, very atmospheric. And as you can see, it's very quintessentially English, with the cornicing, the coving, the wood panelling. We are in the heart of London, and I think Arbutus and Wild Honey, more so Wild Honey now, is a real representation of that.
Now, how about the concept of the menu? And I have a copy of the menu in front of us, and there are different parts of it. So I'd like for you to explain how this menu works. And then, if you would, if there's so many things that I love on this, tell us or describe, probably in more detail than just telling us, what we ought to aim for our lunch.
I'm a great believer that all good cooks utilize the seasons as much as possible, and to obtain the best indigenous produce available. We're just on the cusp of winter. It's a beautiful day today, actually. The sun's shining for once here. You could be in the south of France today. A chill in the air, some beautiful sunshine. But the menu today, we've got game on the menu. You can see partridge. We've got woodcock. It's England's full of beautiful game, full of beautiful produce. We offer a working lunch, which is £35, which is all in, which includes the coffee and cannelé and chocolates. And that is where we really pitch ourselves very well for Mayfair. I'd like to think that we are kind of the best value lunch in Mayfair. We run an a la carte menu, which changes daily. Not all the dishes do, but as I say, today we're on the phone looking for what's in available for tomorrow's menu. But today, it's a shame you weren't here yesterday, because we had a fantastic venison bolognese on, which proved very popular and, of course, sold out within, a couple of hours of the day. So it's a real ode to winter, and this is where, this stirs the soul. It's a very warming menu. Some great things on there. Very feminine too, so you could opt for a little salad or a little crab dish or a burrata with some grilled pears, or you can go into the masculine side and you can have a piece of artisanal grilled black pudding with a fried egg, or you could have something like the foie gras and pheasant boudin blanc. So there's a multitude of things there, and it's quite a big menu. We've got a choice of three starters, three mains, and three desserts for the working lunch, and on the a la carte, we've got a choice of six starters and six mains. So there's a choice for everyone, really.
How about walking us through some of the, I find, more curious dishes? The roast partridge. I would say the, and then you have a partridge and foie gras, and you have a roast duck. Oh, and the rabbit. Could you walk us through the components of each of those dishes?
Well, the rabbit has become a bit of a signature dish. I hate the title signature dish, because it normally kind of insinuates that the chef never changes the menu. But this dish is become synonymous with what we do here. I can't sell chicken. It's a meat I just cannot sell. Chicken, we just can't sell chicken at all. But rabbit, being a very close in terms of white meat, is a huge seller. It's probably our biggest selling meat item. It's French rabbit, completely deboned, and then we stuff the rabbit with its liver and its kidney, then we wrap it in pancetta, and then we roast it. It was featured on the MasterChef, MasterChef Professionals, which is a BBC program. The semi-final was held here, and that was one of the dishes that I put through the contestants to actually try and achieve.
So anyone?
Was it true what you said when you came in? You said, "Oh, my rabbits are just arriving."
Yeah, we've as you know, this time of year with any capital city, traffic is an absolute nightmare. My French delivery has just arrived, and where are we? We're half an hour away from lunch. So my rabbits, it's going to be all hands on deck to get the rabbits prepared. It's a very laborious task, and this time of day will require three or four cooks just to dedicate their time to butcher and wrap and stuff the rabbits.
How about walking us through also, you have two partridge dishes.
I've got two partridge dishes on. One.
Can you also sing 12 Days of Christmas?
In a pear tree. I've got two partridge dishes on. One is the highly revered grey leg, and one is the red leg. The grey leg is a wild bird, which is becoming less and less frequent. The red leg is a farmed bird. Still shot. I mean, they're farmed and then released into the wild, and therefore shot by the guns. But the working lunch has got the red leg, and we serve that with some Lebanese frika wheat.
I love it.
Which is beautiful, with a bit of pomegranate, which is bang in season, some toasted seeds. We make a little croûte, which we spread on the farce of the bird with a bit of Armagnac and foie gras, and serve it with some Brussels sprout tops. So very, very simple, really. But whenever I'm devising a dish or a menu, I look to the, especially from the birds, cattle, poultry, what their natural diet would be, and implement that into their garnish. Pretty straightforward, pretty simple thinking, but it works.
Now, your desserts for England, I must say, because I've never seen such a collective sweet tooth in my life, your desserts seem to be restrained, shall we say.
I have only four desserts. One of them is the classic French tarte tatin, which is our biggest seller. Take some beating, I must say. I'm kind of late to the party when it comes to Instagram and things, but if you look at my Instagram account and see my tarte tatin, it takes some beating. I must self-confess, showing all humility, I'm quite proud of it. So we've got an apple dessert. We have a chocolate dessert, which is an absolute must in winter. We have a fruit, exotic fruit sorbet, which is the mango, which is with coconut and yogurt, a bit of salted yogurt. The yogurt is house made, and then we have a very, very, very famous wild honey ice cream, which is made with London wild honey. The honey is not heat treated at all, so it hasn't lost any of its healthy properties or any of its really beautiful aroma. And cheese. So four desserts plus cheese. And of course, not forgetting the classic English custard tart, which is on the lunch menu, which, as you know, any cookery that requires the addition of eggs, whether it be scrambled eggs, boiled eggs, souffles, omelettes, requires huge amounts of skill. That to me is a sign of a great cook, whether he can pull off a great souffle or a great omelette or a great tarte au citron or a custard tart.
Now, I mean, as you know, America is totally cocktail crazed, but I was surprised to see at the top of your list one of Peter's favorite drinks, the Negroni, but this one is House Bourbon Barrel Aged Negroni. And then you also have a Vintage Negroni. Those are kind of startling, I think, for this menu. Tell us about your bar program in general, and also, do you have a concept for your wine list?
Well, I'm glad you noticed that, because pizza's got great taste, because Negroni is my favourite drink. And but we barrel age our own Negroni mix. Now, Chris is the man to speak to. He's my general manager and my wine sommelier. He also takes care of the cocktail list. But since I took control of Wild Honey, the wine ethos has changed. Very similar to my stance on food, to search quality ingredients, small artisanal producers that are really passionate and driven about their product. And that resonates through what we do here, whether it's a simple cocktail, whether it's a simple table wine from France. Everything has been researched and implemented into what we believe is a great experience in the dining room. A lot of our wines are natural, not all of them, but chosen carefully. Everyone seems to be jumping on the natural wine bandwagon, but you have to be careful. A lot of it's not great, but I think it's a movement, a bit like the bistronomy movement, where Arbutus was found. It's here to stay. And people are very conscious about what goes into their food. We're all looking for a more natural, indigenous product. And that goes completely across the board.
Well, I think this place is not only a delicious place, but it's also, you're so rational and lucid about your direction, and that's why I think that you've tackled this whole new challenge.
Listeners, you also might be interested in the fact that, Anthony, I'm pretty sure you're a Londoner.
In fact, I'm not a Londoner. I'm from Stratford-upon-Avon. I've been in London. I don't sound like a Londoner today. I'm suffering with a man cold, which happens to me every winter. And I'm a big, keen cyclist, so it's really frustrating me at the moment that I can't get on my bike. But I hail from Stratford-upon-Avon. I've been in London for about 25 years, so I do class myself as a Londoner. I have two young children, which are Londoners, 11 and 9, Max and Otis. You could call me a Londoner.
I was going to say, just in case you're wondering, I think he sounds a lot like Michael Caine too. Has anybody ever said that to you?
It's the first. You're the first, Peter. Maybe it's this. Maybe it's the congestion I have, but it's killing me at the moment.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I know you have some rabbits downstairs. You have to start working on them, because we sure as hell hope we're going to have some. So we better let you go. We will be able to catch up with Chris to talk to him for a few minutes before we leave.
Chris will be delighted to speak to you after lunch. And as I've said, I've just touched on a kind of cocktail and wine policy. He's definitely the man to speak to. I just hope you've got a lot of time, because once it gets going, you can't stop him.
If we do nothing else today, we will be entirely happy. We will be content. So I'm glad we quickly corrected earlier on that you were not expecting us to stay for lunch. we certainly intend to. We know we're going to have a wonderful time. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
It's great to have you guys, and it's nice to see that you're well, and you've arrived in London when the sun's shining.
You'll notice that everybody seems to really care when the sun goes out.
Yeah, it's such a rarity.
and it was very nice to be sitting in the front window.
Yes.
Of their newly remodeled and very fine Wild Honey restaurant. And while we were sitting there, and before we go to break here, we caught up with Chris, who is the
sommelier
and the general manager.
Right.
who, interestingly enough, said he was going to spend his Christmas holidays in Newquay, Cornwall,
surfing.
but he's certainly very devoted to the product of the grape from the vine as well. And we had an interesting chat about that, which we'll bring you right now, and then right after that we'll take a break.
Listeners, by now, of course, you know that Peter loves talking about wine, and will actually sometimes go away when I find someone to talk about wine with, because she knows that we're going to do that, and she's going to find that interesting, but not as interesting as we do. Christophe Cavaille, General Manager and Sommelier at Wild Honey, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you, vamos, thank you.
Now, I like reading wine lists, and I read the one, Chris, that you put together. And when I got to a full page of yellow wine, I knew I was in the right place. Tell us some more about, Chef mentioned that you really wanted to have a unique wine program, and you're, I guess, is the one who created that. So explain to our listeners what it was you were trying to achieve.
Well, wine is one of my passions, so things that I want to achieve really is bringing something new to the customers. Something that, you know, you don't see anywhere else. Working with small suppliers, because one of my big passion is biodynamic and organic wines. And I think we, everywhere in the world now, we have a new generation of winemaker coming up now. And the understanding and the vision of wine is completely different. I just wanted to, through my wine list, I just wanted to show their talent and their creativity to customers and make customers discovering, you know, new wine, and like orange wine and skin contact and organic and biodynamic wine. So this is really the direction I'm going for.
And you said something very interesting about wine countries around the world, and the ones you thought that right now were perhaps the ones you thought were the best. I thought your answer was unusual. Why don't you repeat it?
People will laugh probably, being French, you know, but I think Spain, South Africa, and Australia, for me, are the top three in the world today.
And all you guys in Napa, and all you guys in Oregon, don't worry, he's not coming there soon, but he did quickly say to me off mic that the Americas is certainly a close number four to those. Now, you also have a cocktail program, and we only saw just a little bit of that with the Negronis that you're serving. But are you going beyond that? And tell us more about these Negronis.
Well, again, I mean, for me, the spirits world is a bit like the wine world. You know, I like working with small suppliers and unusual products. When it comes to Negroni, I'm a huge fan of Negroni. So I've been aging Negroni in cask. I've been doing some research, which I found vermouth, Campari, and gin who's been bottled in the late 60s. And I've done a Negroni with the, you know, with all those three combined. I created a Negroni with mezcal. So, yeah, like I said, it's like the bar. It's like the wine store. It's all about finding unusual products and making, again, people discovering new things, or not necessarily new things, but something like the Negroni, something different than just a classic Negroni, by telling customer, yes, we can use, you know, an edge Negroni, or you can do that yourself at home as well, or you can use, you know, Campari or anything from the, you know, late 60s or 50s, or and again, it's all about research and try to make, you know, customer discovering new products, really.
Well, let's do a recap of the wine pairings that you did for us today. Can you remember them? And perhaps with each one you can say, like, just a couple of words about why you chose that particular wine.
So with the crab, I choose a Pinot Grigio on skin contact. Skin contact for 3 weeks, made by a very talented winemaker from Slovenia, who's based north of Italy. And because the skin contact of Pinot Grigio gives something very fruity, a little bit more tannin than usual, but, you know, very fruity with the crab, I thought it was, you know, a good combination, and I think you did agree, and I was very pleased with that. With the next course, the burrata, I choose a Nebbiolo. But again, a Nebbiolo from Australia, from Adelaide Hills, made by someone called Tom Shawbrook. And Tom Shawbrook is one of the most, for me, one of the most talented winemakers in Australia today. And again, it was not a big Nebbiolo. It was something very elegant, light, full of fruit, a bit more acidity than the normal Nebbiolo. But again, with the burrata, it was perfect. And with the rabbits, I choose again a new world wine, from South Africa, 100% Syrah, made by someone called Greg Hawkins. And again, if you expect a big Syrah, it was completely opposite. It was 12% ABV, very delicate, you know, still, you know, a lot of fruits and dark and velvety color, but, you know, very elegant and very feminine. With the rabbit, I think it was a good combination as well.
So when you come to Wild Honey, just turn yourself over to the chief of the wine list and have him surprise you wonderfully in the same way he did us. Chris, thank you so much. And since it's a season, we wish you happy holidays. Bon Noël, I think, or something like that.
Well, thank you for having me here, and thank you for coming to Wild Honey, and I wish you a Merry Christmas to you guys and to everybody who's listening.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and we really, really enjoyed Lyle's. We had tried to get there before, because I've read a lot about it, and finally our plans worked this time, and we had a lovely time and a really lovely conversation with the chef owner, James Lowe, who's, as Peter mentioned, is one of the Young Turks.
Real thoughtful guy.
Oh, he's terrific.
Listen closely if you're interested in a Young Turk's view of Gordon Ramsay and Heston Blumenthal and a few other pearls of wisdom. But the most interesting thing that I think James said was that he wants his restaurant, Lyle's, to be on the short list that everyone who comes to London to dine is on.
Right.
And before, most immediately before that, he was at a very well-known restaurant called St. John Bread and Wine, and he said everybody had St. John Bread and Wine on their list of places they had to dine, so I want to be in the same place. Quite an interesting ambition and a little different than a lot of chefs. And the other interesting thing he said was his first target is he hopes to be in business 10 years from now, or a total of 10 years. Then he'll feel he really has achieved something. Just between you and me, go there, because he's achieved something fairly important already, and we're sure you'll have a great time if you do that.
Well, right off the plane, I will not say we are jet lagged, because I don't ever admit to jet lag. But here we are in London, and our very first venture out to dine has been at Lyle's, and we've been meaning to come here for a couple of years and finally made it. And we're going to be talking to James Lowe, the head chef of this restaurant. And James, we loved our food, and I feel totally revived.
That's brilliant. Great news. I'm really happy to hear that you had got such a great time. It's stunning. Amazing. Straight off the plane, that's brilliant.
You have had a trail of publicity about how you started out in this business, grouping together with a group that was not even sarcastically or anything called the Young Turks Collective. Let's skip back before that. Where did you go? Where did you cook? How did you get to this point in London?
Well, I started a couple of years after university. I moved to London, and I had a couple of really amazing experiences at restaurants like St. John and the Fat Duck. And I was so blown away by kind of this, by discovering European food, that European food could be exciting and interesting by eating at St. John and the Fat Duck, that I just thought, I need to open a restaurant. So the first thought being, I need to open a restaurant, I thought, well, how do I do that? What's the best way? And I felt like the best way, or the most interest, or the one that spoke to me the most, was to learn to cook. So I was eating out a lot, and I just went to the restaurants that I really loved, told them that I really loved their restaurant, and really wanted to work in their kitchens. and which was quite hard at first because no one wants to take on someone post-university who they think isn't really suited for kitchens. And you kind of, and they know you're going to be useless when you start. And sometimes you're more than a burden than you are a help. So, but I was lucky enough, persistent enough to get a couple of really good people to take me on.
St. John and Burgess Henderson, we know. What are some of the other restaurants?
So I started, was working in a place called the Whopping Project, which was I think, what British food was, the best of British food was about at the time. It was a, the term at the time was modern European. That meant it was very eclectic. There was a chef, very famous chef called Alistair Little in the 90s, who kind of pioneered this idea of, he would do things like, he was very well traveled, so his menu would have, he'd have like a tuna tataki dish, Japanese influence, he'd have a bisque from south of France, he would have a Catalonian dish on, he would have a risotto on, just kind of a best bits or a greatest hits of food that he really loved. But the philosophy behind them was always the same. There's always, you know, three things on a plate. A very simple, simple food, but good food, or kind of the peasant food of many countries. And that for a while, like 90s, early 2000s, was what really fueled or was a signature of gastropubs and of the start of revolution of food in London, in my opinion.
Yeah, now Raymond Blanc thinks that he revitalized the food movement. He said that he saved the whole culinary scene in England, you know.
I think that what happened in the 60s, 70s, places like the Gavroche, the Manoir, were important, but I don't think they were as important as people like Fergus or people like Heston. Some people absolutely love and worship Marco Pierre White and Gordon Ramsay. I personally feel like all they did was reproduce a style of French food. I don't think they've really left a legacy in the same way that people like Fergus have, Heston, someone like René from Noma, someone like Michel Brass in France. Those people changed how people cook and changed restaurants. Ramsay just did, you know, what people have been doing already. Marco just did what people have kind of been doing, but he was one of the first and he was British, so it was kind of, it's quite important, but I don't really think there's anything necessarily left from that.
Now, in all the articles I've read, they say that you actually, as a group, these young chefs, the young Turks, you had these certain rebellious principles, which, you know, you're looking back now, how many years later, and they weren't so rebellious. Everybody who's a chef of any kind of, if you can call yourself a chef, you follow those things like simple compositions, simple presentations even, good ingredients. How has anything changed, or has it?
I think it always amazed me at the time that really latched on or as interested as they were in what we were doing. I was really happy, obviously, because people were coming to eat the food, which was great, and we were throwing really good fun events. But with the reason why we kind of got together in the first place was because I was kind of, I'd traveled a lot, I'd eaten abroad a lot, I'd worked abroad a lot, so had Isaac and Ben, the other chefs with me, and we just always came back to London and just kind of couldn't understand why everyone was going on about what an amazing city London was, and oh my word, best food city to eat in the world, and I just felt that we were so behind in some ways. And what we did in London, the style, the format, wasn't really, I didn't really feel like it was all that new. We weren't trying to be, groundbreaking. We were just throwing a party with really good food, and we were kind of cooking what we wanted to cook. Thing was, it was quite different for London because we were still obsessed with Gordon Ramsay style French restaurants. Michelin Guide was still very, very important to everyone. People weren't doing, British food was kind of stuck in pubs and was not, I didn't feel like it was going anywhere. I felt like St. John, massively important, brilliant restaurant, but there was nothing happening from that. it promised to kickstart something, but people weren't really kind of carrying the torch forward from that, I didn't feel. And we didn't want to work for anyone else, wanted to do our own thing, but were seriously lacking in money, and restaurants take an awful lot of money, so the easiest way around that is to find a space that people don't want and try and do what you can for as little money as possible. And the events were really good fun.
A name just crossed my mind that you haven't mentioned, but which, you know, I see some similarities in views of the culinary world. Simon Rogan at Faro is who I'm thinking of.
Simon's great. I spent about 2 days with him about up in Longkloon about 7-8 years ago. I really found that was such a fantastic place, and his restaurant changed and evolved quite a lot, kind of starting off on a more fat duck style, kind of really kind of pushing the crazy, you know, the molecular chef angle. I remember one of his desserts was like a sticky toffee pudding, but it's in 5 spheres, so you eat these 5 spheres and you're left with the feeling that you've eaten a sticky toffee pudding, which was really not my scene. And it was interesting to be there when I was there, because he was very much in the middle of this farm-based, ingredient-led food, a more simple style, but still at the tail end of the previous kind of style that he had going. So we had the menu at the time. I remember the nights I was there, I was kind of, some of it it really spoke to me and I thought were fabulous, and then some were just, I just thought, this is really not my style. And it was very strange to see that. He probably won't be that happy with somebody saying that the menu didn't chime together properly, but I just saw so much potential because he just started working with a few small farms. I remember bringing in, so it was June, he was bringing in some amazing British broad beans, broad bean leaves, cooking with some ingredients that I was struggling to find myself, wanted to find, but then doing a take on them that I wouldn't have done. And it was kind of interesting to see that. But I was really, I left feeling really envious that he was able to get access to these things. And I thought, how do I get them in London? That was my big mission at the time, was how do I find these things? But he, the restaurants in Longkloon is incredible. What it's kind of become, especially in the last, I don't know, seven or so years, is five, 6 years, is brilliant. And he's doing, I feel, another type of modern British food that's really up there alongside St. John. And it's much more high end. It's not really my style because it's more destination restaurant. It's more, you know, you take a journey up to the Lake District to go and eat there. It's very expensive. You might want to stay there for the night. And, you know, the whole experience thing he's very, very keen on, that I don't try to create at all. Just we are mainly just a place to come and eat.
Yeah, but let's not joke around here, James. You are holding a Michelin star in Shoreditch, which the rest of the world, I'm sure, said would never happen. And you're firmly footed in the second 50 best restaurants in the world. So you did that based on some pretty good food. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the dishes we enjoy today?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. All the Michelin and the 50 best thing is strange and unexpected. It's not, I think after a couple of years of cooking, it's not something that I ever really aimed for. I'm very aware of what those things can do for a restaurant, and I'm really happy that we've got them. I mean, we were struggling in our first year. The Michelin star has helped massively. We're doing the numbers that we're supposed to be doing, so we're able to repay loans and, you know, all the things that you have to do, the kind of on the side of cooking. So that's brilliant. That's made me very optimistic for the future, because I think, okay, we're not going out of business. We've got, you know, we're going to have time to experiment, to really grow, and to get to where I want this place to get to. But I just feel that I've seen too many places that their aim is to get a star, or their aim is to get into a list or an award of some kind. And I feel that you see a restaurant kind of stall sometimes after that happens. If your goal is to get a star and you work 4 years to get it, once you've got it, I've seen so many places that that's it. They go nowhere from that. They've done what they wanted to do and they start cruising. And I feel like I started cooking very late, so I've always had this fear of wasting time. And I've had in my head this idea that I'm going uphill to get to where I want to be. And if ever something doesn't change enough, or then I feel like I'm slowing down. And I feel like if you slow down, you run the risk of going backwards, going back down. I just always want to keep changing, keep being better. Not for the sake of changing, but just to evolve and to know that there's better ways of doing everything we do. And that's where I want to get to. And we're 2.5 years into the restaurant. We're 3 in March. And I don't really... The first goal is 10 years. Like, that's the first kind of celebration. I've worked at restaurants like the River Cafe, which is 25 years old. I've worked at the St. John, which is over 20 years old. I ran St. John Bread and Wine for 5 years, which is now 12 years old. You know, those are restaurants that I think are amazing. Fat Duck is 20 years old plus. Like, those are restaurants that I think are really incredible. And I don't think I'm really going to be happy until we're there.
Well, you told us a lot about what you don't want to be. You don't want to be a destination restaurant. You don't want to have this kind of reputation where, you know, you're a Michelin star and are stalled. I mean, what is it that you really want? I mean, St. John's is a destination restaurant. So is the River Cafe. I mean, what is it you want your restaurant to be?
I think what I want this for Lyle's is to be the place that at any given time, and for whatever type of person you are, or whatever you want, however much money you want to spend, you recommend or you feel like you have to go to Lyle's to see. I feel like we provide the best snapshot of what's available in this country and what's best at the moment at any given time for lunch menu or dinner menu. And what I want to be is, what I thought was fantastic when I worked at St. John Bread and Wine was that if you get people traveling to London and they're eating, you will have on their list, they'll have their tick list, they're kind of their 5 places they have to go to. And what I used to love was that if people are coming to London and they want high-end restaurants, they want to eat at the Fat Duck and they want to eat at whatever, Ramsay's or St. John, River Cafe, whatever, they pick all the, you know, super fancy restaurants, but they also always used to want to go to St. John Bread and Wine. If people come into London and they want to see the ethnic diversity of our restaurants, you know, they'll go to Mangal, they'll go to Thai Abs, they'll go to a couple of street food places, but they would also eat at St. John Bread and Wine. And I found that was really amazing, and that's a really fantastic thing to be. So I'm trying to make Lyle's what I want it to be, is a destination, not a destination restaurant. A destination restaurant for me is somewhere like the sorts of restaurants that are on the 50 best list are. They are places where they try and create an experience from the moment you kind of enter the door, and they feel like it's their duty to look after you, take you on a whirlwind tour, spark nostalgia, do whatever they do. And they're kind of, you know, they're aiming for 3 stars or whatever that is. It's just not really the sort of place I want. I want a place where people come for dinner or lunch, and that's it. And so I kind of would love it if, no matter what you're after when you come to London, you feel that you have to visit Lyle's. And I feel like you should do, because I think we're the best representation of what's available. And I think that we are really good value. I think we're laid back. I think the staff are really knowledgeable and nice, but we don't push anything on people. There's not this massive desire to tell stories about the food. It's just, you know, if people are interested, we have the information for them, but we don't force anything on anyone. And I just I feel like you can come here and be totally at ease and just be fed and leave and just think, what a fabulous place. But also, if you want to know more, then we can do that too. But it, ultimately, just come in, have some nice food and with nice people.
Say that we really enjoyed the experience of being here. And we were close enough to our next door neighboring table that we could talk. And we found out we had a really close connection. And they're from Sweden, we're from the United States. But we had interviewed somebody who turned out to be the best friend of the guy sitting at the table next to us, and that was the guy who recommended that he come to this restaurant. It was amazing. But anyhow, but in addition to that, we also liked the food. And you have a certain style of your food that I don't know how to explain it. A part of it is you have this sense of, well, I mean, it's sort of like the Sicilian style that I was raised on, which is the agrodolce, which is the balance between the sweet and the sour. Our listeners love to know the details of food. They're not just in this theoretically. They want to know and almost taste what you serve. Tell us a little bit about your menu and what you cook, because if you can, tell us like what inspired these combinations, because they're not routine. They're very different.
Yeah, I think the food comes from, I feel like it's influenced from everywhere. Everywhere I've traveled, everywhere I've eaten, some people say there's a very strong Japanese influence sometimes. Sometimes if a dish is has lots of interesting textures or like kind of a slightly chewy texture, people say, oh, it's a bit Chinese. People said it definitely Italian. I feel that it's from all over. There's certain things on the menu that I can point to and I kind of see, you know, very clear influence or what it was that kind of prompted me to do that dish. I think what's really important amongst how the menu changes is that the food is very different through the seasons. And you hear very often people say their menu is very seasonal. But you'll see that they'll have a lamb chop on their menu all year round. And it's the same lamb chop from the same age of animal, which does not work in a kind of a farmer's cycle. You get a spring lamb in the autumn, you get mutton in the winter, you get hogget or year-old lamb in the summer. You know, so you're using different types of lamb throughout the year. And they'll serve it with a salad leaf in the summer and a cabbage in the winter. But that's not seasonal food. That's just changing something that's available, but it's essentially the same food. I feel like there's genuinely different personality to the food in the spring, summer, autumn, winter at this restaurant. Food is very much more vibrant, exciting, I think slightly more feminine, lighter, more acidic, more fun in the summer. I think in the winter it's more comforting, fortifying. There's very different style of dishes. We have when you kind of have chefs in the kitchen throughout the summer, we don't reduce any meat stocks at all. I never reduce meat stocks. We kind of layer them. We'll cook them three or four times. But in the winter, we'll start doing things. And so that today we had an oxtail dish on. So I'll talk about the oxtail dish. But that's kind of we put that on the menu for the first time on Thursday, 2 days ago. And the chef I was making it with, we finished it, and I said, okay, cool. Now we're going to reduce the hell out of this stock. And then he was like, whoa, what happened to the we don't reduce stocks rule? And I was like, well, that's, yeah, 9 months of the year, that's the rule. But at the moment, this dish suits it. It's a rich braised beef dish. It's what it needs. It needs to be a bit heavier, a little bit sticky. It's what suits it. I'm not trying to reinvent everything too much. It's just what feels right with that ingredient. So this dish is a buttermilk crumpet. Crumpets. I have no idea how to describe what a crumpet is. It's an old school British kind of bread crust with a batter recipe. So it's kind of like an American pancake, but it's not. It's thicker and it's more bready. But it cooks in the same way in that it has you put self raising flour in it, and it becomes very aerated. But it's much heavier, and it's something that's traditionally a breakfast kind of dish, and it's the sort of thing that I used to love having toasted when I was younger. My nan used to make it, and we'd put Marmite on it, which is this really, again, probably no one knows what Marmite is. It's a really, you know what Marmite is. It's a yeast paste, essentially, and I absolutely used to love it when I was a kid. I've always loved salty, funky flavors, and so we make this buttermilk pumpkin. We ferment barley, and we blend that with buttermilk and the batter mix for the crumpet. So we kind of cook this little bready crumpety thing to order. We braise the oxtails. We first of all get the oxtails dry aged, so they take on a much stronger beef flavour. We brown them off in aged beef fat. All the time, whatever we do, every ingredient, we try and think, how can we improve each thing? So rather than simply going, well, let's put more expensive alcohol in the braise, let's reduce the braise more, it's like, well, what if we get beef from, they're all rare breed cattle. What about, let's hang those tails so that they kind of, they dry a little bit, they get a stronger flavor. And so it's kind of at all links of the chain, from the farmer, from the butcher, to us, and then the final cooking, we kind of say, how can we make that part better, or how do we improve that part of it? And it's kind of a lot of groundwork, or a lot of years sometimes, finding the right person to do it, finding the right cattle, that creates a really simple dish. And sometimes people can be fooled by how simple these dishes are. They'll kind of, you can quite easily buy an oxtail and braise it, but if you don't make the stocks in the same way we do, if you don't age the tails, if you don't cook it the length of time at the same temperature we do, then it just doesn't create the same result. And I think all those small details along the way are so, so important. So that's an oxtail, but essentially it's an oxtail braise, and it's kind of very old school, because you're doing a braise with, there's an old fashioned British thing called a trencher, which is like a, if you were doing a roast beef, you'd serve the roast beef on a bit of old roast bread. The idea being that you don't waste anything. You soak up all the juices in the bread, and you know, you used to kind of in the feasting times of the Middle Ages or whatever, or the times of Henry VIII, you'd have this the roast beef would go to the wealthy, and then the trencher or the bread underneath would be given to the help, the staff and the kitchen people, or the kind of the poor people at the edge of the party. So it's kind of drawing on all sorts of things that I love about food, British ingredients. There's history to it. There's it's very traditional in a way. And we serve with chard that we brush and grill with our wood on over our grill, because I love to pick up another flavour. That we brushed it with the aged beef fat, and it's kind of and then a really nice homemade red wine vinegar that we use from all our, that we save from all our wine tastings. And it's just, I don't know, all those little things that we do that are a little bit different, I think, hopefully makes the dish better. And it's not something, when we put the dish down, we introduce it as a crumpet and oxtail. But if people are interested in it, I really think that people are smart enough to understand or to notice really good food. They might not necessarily know why, but I feel like it's very common in kitchens to, when things aren't quite right, just to simply say, is anyone going to notice? And that, honestly, it drives me crazy, because it happens in the best restaurants in the world. Is anyone really going to notice? And I don't, the answer to everyone says, I don't care if they don't notice. I notice. I know that we haven't done it right. So no, it's not going out.
There is, I don't know. I have various categories of chefs. One is my philosopher chef, and I put Massimo Bottura in that classification. You might be my intellectual chef, but your food is too gutsy to be just the brain. I mean, the flavors are really earthy and gutsy. Let's let people know what to expect when they get here, because you have fairly well thought through, again, systems here. You have an a la carte menu at lunch. You have a set lunch, and then you have a dinner set menu that there's no choice. Tell us about these different options.
Okay, so thanks for it. I'm really glad you said the food was gutsy, because I love seasoning and I love strong flavors.
You can tell.
I think, like, there was a period there where everyone was cooking modern food, and that meant no salt, no punchy flavors, because it was somehow supposed to be more elegant. And we had a bit of a joke with a bunch of the people I worked with at the time. It was just we just were eating in restaurants and getting all this food that people were saying was so beautiful, so elegant. And we were just sitting around just going, can someone just bring us the tasty stuff, please? Can we just have some tasty food? What happened? Where did all the tasty food go? Yeah, this is really intellectual, but it tastes of nothing. And I felt like they were using it as an excuse to not cook right, to say that, no, you just don't understand it. It's like, no, I understand it. I just don't think it's very good. But anyway, so yeah. And also, you know, it's December, so it's wintry. It's cold outside. It's bloody miserable in London right now. So we're cooking. You know, there are some punchier things. And there's what have we got? There's game broth on the menu. There's a pumpkin that we roast in the wood oven to kind of intensify that flavor. It's with a sauce that's made from the reduced whey from our homemade butter. So you've got this like properly sour, cheesy, highly seasoned kind of sauce with it. Sardines on the menu. These are curried straight from Cornwall.
I love the sardines. I haven't had sardines that good in years.
Good. I'm glad. I think that's just really important. When people, I've got quite a few foreign chefs in the kitchen. No one knows what sardines are. Everyone knows what raw mackerel is because every restaurant in the world does it. But sardines, they get curried in. They came in this morning. We just cleaned them up. We didn't have to do anything to them. We grilled them. We served them with it's like a vinaigrette we make from the from a stock that we make from the grilled heads and livers from the fish. So again, this is another one that's I guess kind of is very different as to we make very we never reduce meat stocks, but we do one thing I do a lot is make light, clean fish stocks. But we tend to grill the bones a lot or roast the bones in the wood oven quite a lot. And we'll make a very nice clean stock and then we reduce the hell out of it. So this is, we make tomato water. So it's like a blended tomato that you hang. So you get a very strong umami stock, a little liquid. We then use that as our stock water. So it's a very, you know, this day already you've got like a day to make the tomato water. Then we grill the bones over the top, kind of high above the grill, so it kind of picks up smoke and dries out in a very Japanese style, I guess, or very Asian style. There's kind of this idea of dried grilled fish bones, but you just, that's not how you make, you know, French fish stocks are white, clean, light, cooked in 20 minutes. This is totally the opposite way. Anyway, so that's a, and then with the sardines are amazing. They're really oily, beautiful fish. And then we do turnip tops, cime de rape, with a very sweet and sour kind of dressing, heavily reduced apple juice, a bit of homemade cider vinegar, a little bit of olive oil, and then it kind of mixes the two things together. You allow the sardines to taste the sardines, and then you've got this greens on the side that's super sweet and sour and really hopefully is nice.
So how does this work? You come in for lunch and you were going to tell us. Tell us that.
Yeah, sorry, I waffle. So the idea is I wanted to do a set menu in the evening because I wanted people to show people what I thought was best at the time. And I felt that during the day, this area, we needed to provide something for the people of this area as well. We couldn't just do this kind of slightly highbrow menu. It wouldn't really work, and I didn't really want to do it. I wanted there to be a grilled meat, always a salad with great leaves, always a broth or a soup, always some kind of like grilled shellfish, or just something that was, if you wanted to come in and have a really simple lunch, just have a whole grilled crab or a bowl of mussels, you could do that, and that would be absolutely fine. And during the day we kind of set aside a third of our tables for people coming in and just have coffee, something baked, they sit on their computers, they'll have a meeting. The other two-thirds of the room will be people having a casual lunch. And then in the evening, I felt like we didn't necessarily need to cater to the locals quite so much because people are more likely to travel in the evening. So we could be a little bit more specific about what we wanted to do. I felt that there might not be enough people in the area who want to have a set menu, but if you take London as a whole, I felt like there would be enough people to, so we wouldn't go out of business and come every night.
It's a tricky ride to Shoreditch to begin with, and for those of you who can master the underground, the tube, it's very much the best way. But then it starts to get difficult because the address is 56 Shoreditch High Street, but the entrance is on Bethnal Green Road. Go figure. Only in Great Britain would they do that. and your Uber driver won't find it either unless you give him that tip. Here's the good news. James and his staff share lots of information. So we've listened to him today talk a lot about what's going on in his head and what's going on in his restaurant. But there's a newsletter that's there all the time. There are menus there every day. There are lots and lots of special events that you do, off cooking with other chefs or having other chefs come and cook with you. So let's just close with the fact that it's now 5 o'clock and there's a table still enjoying lunch. Dinner service will be starting momentarily, so we better get out of here so there's room for them to do that. What's the website? And let's end there. Thank you so much, James, for talking to us.
Cheers, thank you very much. All the information we have is on lyleslondon.com, lyleslondon.com, and we have a newsletter, and we do lots of events, like an event called the Guest Series, where we invite chefs that I think are doing some really interesting things from all over the world to come cook here. It's kind of really good for the restaurant, really good for me, really good for my staff, all to kind of see different viewpoints and have some appreciation for what other people do, and also hopefully be inspired by what they do and follow their own path.
What do we say? Rue Britannia, I guess.
And we'll be back, same time, same place, same city coverage next week. So be sure to join us then, and in the meantime,
bye-bye.